Welcome, everyone, to the Australian Bitcoin Podcast. You're listening to myself, Justin, and Jeremy from hardblock.com.au, Australia's first and oldest Bitcoin-only exchange. Sign up to Hardblock using the referral link in the description to receive free auto-send batched withdrawals for the next 6 months. For full disclosure, Jeremy and I did not personally receive any benefit if you use the referral link. The code is purely for you to receive free batched withdrawals for the next 6 months. In today's episode, we'll be discussing recent global and local Bitcoin news. All right, Jeremy, how's it going?
Yeah, pretty good. Big day in markets.
Yeah, indeed. I think there's going to be some sad people, but at the same time, if you have a long-term view, there'll be some very, very happy people stacking sats today.
Yeah, it's just one of those days that I never have enough cash, but or any cash. But I did notice Bitcoin does seem to have bottomed out, hopefully. We might be proven wrong, but it did get just below 30K US dollar terms, down to 29,741. So
that's it. There's been some very strong support there. It hasn't been broken so far in the last, well, I feel like 18 months or more now. So yeah, to test that makes the 30, a lot of sense.
The 30 seems to be holding it. So if you got that price, well done. but yeah, it looks like all of the markets are really tanking at the moment. So yeah, just try and stay patient and stay calm, and I'm sure it will resolve itself.
Exactly right. I've had this running thing that I'm monitoring from like the All Ordinaries and the S&P 500 from around March 2020 before the big kind of COVID crash. And of course, looking at the Bitcoin price and either US dollars or Australian dollars since then as well. And I think that's always brings a good perspective to it, because I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people asking Bitcoiners, you know, what do you think about the price? It's very volatile. The price is dumping. However, if you look at Bitcoin's price from that point until now, it's still up something about 10 times, depending on where you draw it, or perhaps even 5 times. Whereas if you look at the stock prices, so the All Ordinaries or the S&P 500, they now have more or less undone the majority of the progress that they made during that time. So the All Ordinaries is now negative from that point.
Yep.
The S&P 500 is still up a little bit, but certainly not keeping up with inflation during that period since then, which has been about 25 months ago. So it seems like a decent stretch of time to track, and gives you just a bit of an impression of how each of the markets are dealing with, I guess, the current state of the world. And in my opinion, Bitcoin's still doing very, very well, despite the move downwards now, because it's nowhere near where it was back in March 2020.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got a traditional super, you're down from March, well, pre-March 2020 to now.
That's right.
Bonds are down as well. Stocks are down. I'm going to go into some details later, but yeah, property is probably the only one that's holding up, I would say, within Australia. I mean, in America, it's a little bit different, but in Australia, you know, property's done well, but everything else in terms of to pre-COVID to now, it's actually down, which is pretty scary considering how much money was printed, and well, I was going to talk about it, how much prices have gone up. So if you compare it, like, not just down to nominal, down to things that you actually need to buy, you're down a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I haven't seen Australia's GDP stat recently, but I've seen America's, and in the most recent quarter, for the last recent quarter, they went backwards about 1.5%. I think it might be 1.4 or 1.6, so let's just say 1.5 to call it even. But to print the amount of money that they printed and then to have a negative GDP for a quarter, yeah, that's pretty scary. It then begs the question of, like, how much needs to be printed to actually then make GDP go back to a positive state.
Yeah, or is it even possible? It's kind of like a drug. Like, you know, you get to a point where there's declining returns.
Exactly.
Not just diminishing returns, but declining returns, even if you put more in.
It's probably a good metaphor for our economy and the central banks. Do they decide to take another hit, or do they deal with the withdrawal symptoms and go through some agony over the next little while?
Yeah, that is the big question, isn't it?
Well, I guess we've got a mixture of news today that is related to the whole world economy and geopolitical situation. So we'll get into the global news first. This is some good news, which is nice. Panama passed legislation that encourages Bitcoin businesses to set up there, and they've made Bitcoin payments and income in Bitcoin, that is, tax-free. Now, I say Bitcoin, but they've done this pretty sweeping to digital assets, generally speaking,
right?
Which I think is still positive as a free market economy. I recall there being some strange stuff about Panama where they're not actually allowed to kind of decree a legal tender. It is really up to citizens to choose what tender that they use.
Right.
However, there were certain taxation laws around most of the common tenders that people would use. So this is big news in the sense that they're not actually allowed to make cryptocurrency or Bitcoin legal tender, but what they've done instead is to make it essentially tax-free, which makes people quite likely prioritize it over the other potential currencies that they could use in Panama instead. like the US dollar, for example.
Yeah, and it's going to encourage people to set up the infrastructure and the Lightning payments. And, you know, once you start traveling there with your Bitcoin, you've got El Salvador on the same continent.
Exactly.
A couple more countries come in and it becomes, you know, almost like the standard.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, I feel like that little pocket, you know, Honduras, Guatemala, and, you know, Mexico is pretty close to that as well. There's been lots of, you know, stirring in terms of potential Bitcoin adoption. I know in the Mexican Senate, they've just put a Bitcoin ATM. And so, I mean, that's not a Bitcoin adoption as such, but it's just creeping in. Just very gradually creeping in.
A little sign.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same as Samson Mao going to Guatemala and Honduras. Lots of, you know, teasers about them maybe accepting it as a legal tender. That island off the coast of Honduras, that kind of autonomous zone adopting it. So, yeah, it's definitely moving in the right direction.
For sure.
So another bit of global news, which is, I think this is good overall, but it starts bad. So people will probably remember the XRP Greenpeace America fiasco from probably about a month ago now. It feels like just a week ago, but XRP paid Greenpeace $5 million US to run a campaign called Change the Code, which was all about putting out essentially energy FUD around Bitcoin with the intention of saying that Bitcoin should move from proof of work to proof of stake, similar to Ethereum, because then it's more environmentally friendly. Of course, that those claims were based on research that technically isn't actually research. One of the papers they cited was just from an undergraduate class project about learning the publication process. So they said a bunch of things in there which haven't actually been tested or verified, but then Greenpeace picked that up and ran with it anyway. So now, unfortunately, the World Economic Forum has done essentially the exact same thing. They've released it's about a two-minute video, again, called Change the Code. They make all sorts of claims in there about how one Bitcoin transaction can power a house for a month. And if Bitcoin gets global adoption, it will raise the global temperatures by about 2 degrees. There's only about 30 people in Bitcoin that need to be convinced to change the code, and all of a sudden it will be done. So there's like quite a lot of FUD in there. A lot of it's energy FUD, but some of it's even like governance FUD, like saying to people, there's only 30 decision makers in Bitcoin. So it's pretty easy to change the code.
If you just use a little bit of logic, like you can get a Bitcoin transaction for sometimes 10, 12 cents. And I can tell you my power bill for my house is more than that.
Exactly.
So right. If I could power my house with a Bitcoin transaction for 10 cents, I would do that.
But yeah.
If you just do a little bit of maths, you're like, no, it doesn't really add up. But
I know.
What I think is interesting is the fact that they felt the need to do this.
Yes.
You know, it's starting to be threatened. They're starting to feel threatened by it.
Exactly.
They've done a poor job of trying to change the narrative, but the fact that they decided to do it is interesting.
Yeah, indeed. And it's like the age-old FUD, really, isn't it? Saying like one Bitcoin transaction can do X, Y, Z. And it seems like that claim is getting bigger and bigger. And it seems like most academics and most places like Greenpeace, World Economic Forum, and sort of shitcoin projects will make those claims. And it seems very like they've verified it. However, the only people that can't seem to verify running their entire house for 12 cents is Bitcoiners. I don't know why. We just can't figure it out for some reason.
Yeah.
So I think there's probably a couple of things just to clarify in there. So if anyone took any of that FUD seriously, is to know that none of those claims are accurate. The 2 degree change in the global temperatures if Bitcoin gets global adoption is untrue. That's based on the Mora et al. Study, the one that I mentioned just before, which is not actually a study. It's a class project, 2 pages, no research was actually done. To also say that 30 people in Bitcoin could agree to change the code and it will be that easy, obviously is not accurate at all. Bitcoin runs on a consensus protocol, which means that if you don't want to run that code, you actually don't have to upgrade your node. And in fact, nodes are not upgraded by default. You need to go there and do that quite specifically. So changing the code is not quite that simple. That actually leads into some news that we'll talk about a little bit later on in terms of finding consensus in Bitcoin. It's quite a confusing thing, not as simple as just talking to a handful of people. So in response to the World Economic Forum's claims, the Bitcoin Mining Council, including Michael Saylor and Jack Dorsey, as well as quite a few other American politicians, they wrote to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. And I don't think this would have been directly in response to the World Economic Forum's claims, but there's a lot of interlinking here. You know, the World Economic Forum is not alone in pushing this FUD, neither is Greenpeace. I would say a lot of this is coming back to just general kind of American government and the debates that are being happening around like climate change and what is, you know, a moral use of energy and so forth. So the Bitcoin Mining Council is targeting that generally speaking, but it came very soon after the World Economic Forum's kind of hit piece, I guess you could say. But what they did in that letter back is they more or less pulled the FUD apart and claimed that, there's no pollution or CO2 from Bitcoin mining directly. It's really about Bitcoin is using electricity. And if there is any CO2 production, that comes upstream from the Bitcoin mining. So I think Bitcoin mining, the word mining kind of conjures up images of, you know, digging in the dirt, upturning, you know, polluting, plumes of smoke, like a manufacturing plant or a factory or a, you know, or a mining facility, but not a Bitcoin mining facility. So they've gone back and actually explained that to say, like, Bitcoin mining in and of itself does not create pollution. So we should be looking at what's upstream of that. And interestingly, Bitcoin has around 58% renewables now in America, whereas the industry standard in America is around 21%. So that's a massive difference that needs to be taken in mind as well. They also sort of targeted the FUD that a transaction has an energy payload, kind of like what we were just talking about before, like it could power a house for a certain amount of time, essentially saying that's rubbish. There is no such energy payload for a transaction. And on top of that, we have things like the Lightning Network, which has, you know, up to a million or more transactions per second, which is very different to the kind of FUD that gets released in this particular Change the Code campaign and other ones similar to it.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, energy is one of those areas where the facts are so different from the story. And a lot of this battle is about the story and the narrative for the mainstream, because the average mainstream person is not going into the facts and they've got a fixed view of the story in their mind. But I think this stuff is useful if someone challenges you and you're like, oh, aren't you worried about the energy? You can say, well, actually, no, because there's a few other things. So, for example, most Bitcoin miners are situated right next to the power production. And if you have to transport the power through high voltage lines, I think you lose about 30% of the power in conversion to higher voltage. So if you situate your miner right next to where the power is being produced, that's not equivalent power. Like it's much more efficient to just get the power straight from the power plant into your Bitcoin miner rather than convert it to high voltage, convert it back to low voltage to go back into your house. The other thing is Bitcoin can use power when people don't need it. So you might say, oh, well, you know, it's consuming the power that I need for my house. Well, if that power was being made by solar power in summer and you need to power your house in winter, Bitcoin is not taking the power for your house. It's taking different power at a different time, at a different location, at a different price.
That's right.
It's just such a complicated area that you kind of almost need an engineering background to understand the full details of that. Yeah, you can kind of just say anything you want and put on Twitter in a headline and
exactly. Try and control people the narrative. Believe it and parrot it. Yeah, very true.
But the truth of the matter is it's very different to that. And I think the free market is kind of showing us that you have companies like Exxon getting into mining, who they make energy, like that's not a story. That's like them actually doing the maths on it going, yeah, we're going to do that. So
exactly,
that's right. The more interesting thing are big companies getting into mining, and Intel is, Exxon is, you know, yes, they are. So yeah, this is just a story that will hopefully go away soon.
I think, yeah, true. I think energy producers especially are seeing that really efficient amalgamation between themselves and Bitcoin miners to become an energy sink, basically to buy the energy that no one else will buy at a particular point,
yep,
or it would otherwise be like wasted. Or it's, you know, very, very difficult and stranded to get to. And I mean, we have so much wasted energy in the world. Bitcoin is using just a very small fraction of that wasted energy. It's
not
taking energy from elsewhere. I guess one final point to throw out there is that World Economic Forum made a claim sort of similar to this back in 2017. They said that Bitcoin was on track to use all of the world's energy by the year 2020.
Yep.
So obviously 2 years beyond that point now, we haven't used all the world's energy. Bitcoin uses less than 1% of the world's energy, in fact. So take the claims with a grain of salt, I would say.
Yes, yep.
So moving on to the IMF, another really great organization. The IMF loaned Argentina $45 billion in US dollars, that is, to bail them out in the currency and financial crisis that they're having over there at the moment. However, in the loan documents, they had stipulations that Argentina must discourage Bitcoin and other cryptocurrency adoptions. And this was coming at a time where Bitcoin adoption in Argentina was starting to escalate in terms of citizens just adopting it quite organically, as well as two, perhaps more, but definitely two major private Argentinian banks were set to release Bitcoin-related products. And right before they were doing so, about a week before, Argentina's central bank has come out and banned this from happening. And I imagine this would be to do with the IMF's loan documents that stipulate they need to discourage such Bitcoin adoption.
No doubt.
And I mean, Argentina's annual inflation rate's past 50% now. So they are in hyperinflation territory for sure. So I mean, the IMF says they are putting those stipulations in place, and the central bank from Argentina is saying that they're enforcing those stipulations for the benefit of the citizens to protect the consumers, essentially. But you could probably also run the hypothesis of, are they just trying to stop people fleeing, you know, using the escape hatch to harder money than the 50% inflating currency that they have?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, when when you're trying to take over the world's money, as Bitcoin is, very powerful people are going to be threatened, and this is how they're going to respond. So we shouldn't be surprised by this. Argentina is an interesting example because they have a very strong history of a black market for currencies.
Mm.
So typically, as I understand it, there's an exchange, official exchange rate for the peso and the USD, and there's the actual exchange rate you can get in the real world in the black market. So a country that is used to having essentially two currencies, USD and pesos, and is used to working on a black market, I think will do just fine on a decentralized cryptocurrency.
True, that's right. You know, like, I've got a bit of experience there already.
Yeah, so I think this is kind of just, again, a bit more posturing. And like, it would have been easier to just go to the bank and get Bitcoin, but I'm pretty confident they're just going to be able to figure it out, how to work out how to use Bitcoin on the black market, use their own node, all that sort of stuff.
It's just that proof that people from an evolutionary perspective are going to converge on the thing that actually helps them survive.
Yes.
And this is a survival moment now for them.
Yep.
And if they already have that culture, that priming from, you know, history, it makes sense that they will still converge on the hardest money regardless of what the regulations say.
Yeah. It's not a country where you have to spend time convincing people about hard money. Like Australia, it's a bit harder because people, the inflation is not so obvious. It's about to be, but it's not so obvious. But Argentina, they know all about this, and they're probably starting to see that the US dollar, their kind of harder money, is also starting to get, you know, inflated away. So, yeah, I can't see that really stopping the black market over there.
And I see that as a positive as well. Bitcoin is, my belief, first and foremost, money for the people. I would rather the citizens get into Bitcoin rather than the institutions and the states. They will get into it eventually. That's a matter of time. So citizens buying it first and foremost is great. So institutions needing to put things on hold for a while the citizens still flee to it, I think is a good thing for average people.
Yeah, definitely.
So another news, a bit of news about the IMF, is that they've expressed some concerns over the Central African Republic's recent decision to adopt Bitcoin as legal tender, similar to the warning that they issued to El Salvador when they did the same thing about a year ago.
Yeah, I feel like if you did something the IMF liked, you'd be disappointed.
Yeah.
You know, like, you kind of want that to happen. And obviously, that's the predicted response. I know you guys talked about it when I was away in the last episode, but I did a little bit of research into this country, which I'd, to be honest, never heard of before.
Like,
so they became independent from France in 1960, and they have a currency that kind of dates back to that history, which they share with five other African countries. It's called the Central African Franc. But the central bank for that currency is in Cameroon. It's not in their own country. It's a very, very poor country, very low internet adoption. But what I think is interesting is seeing one country in a kind of pool of six moving to Bitcoin. If they start selling off their local reserves and buying Bitcoin, kind of incentivizes the next ones to do that before the last, they don't want to be the last one left with like carrying in the bag of all these worthless Central African francs. But then in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, what about like the euro? It's like the same setup. You know, I don't know, was it 28 countries share that one currency, which is controlled by a central bank that you don't control? What if one country in the euro moves to it and then another one and another one, then people will be fleeing from the euro? So it's kind of an interesting model, very early days. I wouldn't even put it past this being some sort of corruption where the heads of state just kind of take the Bitcoin, but unfortunately. But again, it's an interesting model. There's many examples. There's other actually regions in Africa with the same setup, the shared currency across, I think it's eight countries. You know, one country going first and then others having to rush to follow. And
that's right.
Yeah, we'll see how this plays out.
I know there is a grassroots movement in Africa already. There's probably multiple, but I'm thinking of Bitcoin Ekasi here, which is set up with a similar model to Bitcoin Beach in El Salvador.
Right.
There's another one. I feel like it's Panama. And look, we posted about it on the Hard Block Twitter page just very recently. Essentially, there's like a third kind of grassroots movement. And I believe it might be Panama or Colombia. Either way, I'll verify that and put it in the show notes. But it's good to see more of these grassroots movements popping up, because that, I think, will drive some of the Bitcoin adoption over there as well, regardless of, I guess, the government reason of getting into it, because it could be, you know, a corruption angle to it at the moment. But I know that there certainly seems to be some movement over there in terms of like on the ground, you know, with the people buying and holding Bitcoin. But you're right, that game theory of all the surrounding countries, if they're sharing reserve currency, that one country is now perhaps dumping for Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Yeah, it begs the question of when do they start doing the same? And you don't want to be the last one still holding onto that reserve currency.
Yeah.
So some more institutional level news. Goldman Sachs, which is a large US bank, one of the largest, has offered its first ever lending facility backed by Bitcoin. And they're generally looking to deepen their Bitcoin product offerings over the course of time. So I think that's just a bit of noteworthy news. Goldman Sachs has seem probably a bit bipolar in the last few years, sometimes saying Bitcoin's going to 100,000, Bitcoin might be a reserve asset, Bitcoin's going to zero, Bitcoin's very risky, and now here's some Bitcoin-backed loans.
Mm.
So I guess kind of watch what they do, not what they say, is my take-home point from this.
And I think like 2 years ago, I think this would have been huge news, but now it's buried in like, you know, countries and other stuff going on. But that's a big deal. Goldman Sachs, like endorsing Bitcoin, essentially, not with their words, as you say, with the product.
Yeah.
It's a big deal. I mean, it's like they had to figure out actually do it. They've had to hire people who understand Bitcoin. Like it's a massive deal.
That's right. And I guess similar news, although I think this might be even more important news, is that Fidelity, who released the Bitcoin First article and research paper probably within the last 6 months, maybe 3 to 6 months ago, which was all about like why it's Bitcoin only and Bitcoin First, not the other sort of shitcoins. But Fidelity, which manages around $2.7 trillion of assets in the pension funds in America, which are called 401ks, they are now allowing their customers to put up to a 20% Bitcoin allocation in their pension funds, which is huge news.
Massive.
And MicroStrategy, which is Michael Saylor's company, probably not unexpectedly, is going to be the first cab off the rank by offering that to their employees, i.e. to allow them to put up 20% Bitcoin holdings in their 401k pensions, which is very cool. There's been some pushback. There was a labor union that said they want to scrutinize this a little bit more. And Elizabeth Warren as well has said she wants to scrutinize this more because it would be perhaps unsafe for employees of MicroStrategy or customers of Fidelity to go into Bitcoin because of its, you know, significant volatility. So, you know, that kind of pushback, I guess, we're expecting, and especially from Elizabeth Warren, who hasn't been very complimentary of Bitcoin's energy use and price and lack of being able to be controlled or surveilled, etc. So that's not unexpected. But at the same time, I think net positive, good news.
Yeah, no one's being forced to do it. Like, you still have the choice, right? But I think that's absolutely massive because, you know, in your daily life, and it's going to get harder. You don't generally have a whole lot of surplus income, but you have to invest your, what we call super, they call 401k. So if all you have to do is click a button and now 20% of that's going to Bitcoin, I think a lot of people do that, especially when they're looking at the stock charts at the moment. So
that's right.
Yeah, I think that's a really huge, huge one.
And I would imagine this is a creep again, like 20%. Fidelity is obviously very pro Bitcoin. They've got $2.7 trillion of assets of their 401ks. They actually manage more assets than that when you look at their broader products. So does this start at 20%? And gradually creeps up to 30 or 40 or something. And I'm not saying soon, but it just, to me, this is, you know, the floodgates kind of gradually cracking open.
Well, what could happen? I mean, I think the way that these bigger companies manage their risk, they don't allow you to do more than 20% in an asset class.
Mm.
But if you start with 20% and it goes up a lot and everything else goes down, well, you might have quite a high percentage in your super by the time you retire.
That's very true. Good point.
So the CPI came out recently for Australia. So we only release ours quarterly, unlike the US. They did a good job of keeping it down to 5.1%. But I had a bit of a look into it. And so the CPI is actually the average for the quarter. It's like a weighted average for the quarter, which kind of makes sense. But if you think about prices just going up during the quarter, you're actually getting the middle of that move, which is really mid-Feb. So it's kind of like saying in April, they're telling you in mid-May, CPI was 5%.
Mm.
But people are kind of going, oh, the CPI is 5%. What's my bond yield? No, the CPI was 5% in mid-February. It's now May. And I'll just give you a couple of price changes between mid-Feb and today that I just got an hour ago. So Brent crude, which is the market that Australia uses to kind of benchmark petrol prices, mid-Feb was $62 a barrel. It's now $106, 70% rise from mid-Feb when the CPI was 5%.
Mm.
Coal, which Australia uses for half of its electricity generation, was $233. I think it's a ton. I'm not sure what the unit is. It's now $377. It's up 62%. So we use that to make half of the power in Australia. It's up 62%. Natural gas price in Australia. So natural gas prices vary a lot in the location because it's hard to transport, but natural gas prices are at the highest in a decade right now. So, and that's all since really the 5% was released. So that's, yeah, just keep it in mind when you quote CPI, when prices are moving fast, it really matters when that the time period it was. The bond yields in Australia and the US too, but in Australia started to move up quite a lot recently. So if you're not familiar with bonds, most people aren't. It's a pretty boring topic, so you probably shouldn't be. But if the interest rate goes up, the value of the bond falls. It's just the way that the calculation works. Take a while to explain that. But the 10-year interest rate, so on a 10-year bond, is 3.5% at the moment. So it's gone up a fair bit, actually quite a lot. And the 3-year rate's gone up to 3%, was 0.1 some time ago. And they were massaging that one or manipulating it. So you, at the moment, you can get 3% on your money, even though inflation was 5% in mid-February, still massively below. So yeah, there's right. a lot of risk there. And we saw bonds move, Australian 10-year bond value move below 80, which is not a great sign for a bond. I think it was around the 110 mark just prior to COVID. So if you've got 40% of your super in bonds and they were worth 110 2 years ago, now they're worth 80, that's not a good outcome, especially when you're only earning 3%, you know, interest on it. So yeah, unfortunately, even though we've seen that come in at 5%, because it's such a slow cycle, quarterly release, and then a few weeks after another quarter, the next one's not going to come out till July. Who knows where that's going to be? But if petrol's up, if crude oil's up 70%, coal's up 60%, those are scary numbers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, just whenever I see inflation, and especially when it it almost doubles, you know, 5.1% from the 3 that we've been running for quite a while.
Yep.
And to know that 5.1% is the lowest they could get it, absolutely, using things like weighted averages, using things like excluding certain things, hedonic adjustments.
Well, not just that. In Melbourne and Victoria, I think they're getting vouchers to go out for dinner. So they included that as reducing the price of eating out.
Yeah,
interesting. Which is because the government was paying for it. Like, that's not a real...
If the government dropped the excise on fuel,
which is that they also, have. Yeah, they have done that.
And so that would also make it look like there's less inflation.
In fact, I think that's why they did that, try and get some of that in the quarter, because they moved it really fast. Mm. Obviously, there's an election too, but I think it went from like 44 cents down to like 22 or something like that. So when you see that the petrol prices here are now back over $2, that's actually worse than it was, because that's without the excise. Like, the excise has come down. So I think I imagine they'll bring it down. It was supposedly a temporary move for 6 months, but I imagine they'll bring it down to close to zero.
Mm.
And, you know, otherwise people will be up in arms.
It'll be interesting to see what the next number print comes out at.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see, do people start kind of changing the way they kind of look at CPI, or do they go, actually, look at my bills. I don't really need the government to tell me the CPI. Like, when does that change happen?
Yeah, so true. Because, you know, I mean, seeing it as everyone has an individual basket of goods, and you need to track your own individual basket of goods. Don't let the government tell you what CPI is at, because you'll know what things you are buying, what things you do need, and what things you do want. And that's where, you know, you should be calculating not even CPI, inflation, you know.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, like, I think there's sort of psychological points. Like, I have a small diesel hatchback, and on a full tank, it's like $100 now to fill out a small, it's like a small car. And I think people have their psychological points where it's like, whoa, okay, that's now $100. I mean, you know, I don't care if the government's telling you 5%. What's going on here?
Yeah, true.
And I think, can employees afford to pay 5% increases? I don't know. Like, it's going to be interesting to see how it all works out.
True. Speaking of inflation, the Labor Party, that is, has unveiled a plan leading up to the election to say that they will provide equity contributions of up to 40% for the purchases of a new home, and up to 30% for purchases of existing homes. So this is only for around 10,000 homeowners, and going through various needs and asset tests, of course.
Mm-hmm.
However, they're needing to do this because of inflation, especially of things like properties, which are a store of value asset, which generally get hit by inflation the hardest. And inflation's at a point now where we posted a recent article that said around 70% of middle income earners are now priced out of the median house prices, which means around 100% of low income earners are priced out of the median house price. So it's getting pretty dire. And in response, the government is going to essentially offer, this is kind of like a subsidy, I guess you could say. It's probably not the technical term, but it's essentially what it is. And generally what subsidies lead to is further shortages and further price rises. And of course, the age-old question of, like, where does this money come from? The government's going to put up that equity, but is that from taxes? Is that from hidden taxes like inflation? It's not like we have a pool of money that we can throw at this that exists currently.
No, and I think Labor's plan for the debt is for it to grow much faster than the Liberals. But when it comes back to the value of the bonds, like, the bonds were falling it down from 110 to 80. The bonds are how the government funds deficit. So if no one wants to buy those,
where's that going to come from?
Yeah, the RBA is going to be buying. But I didn't realize it was only 10,000 people or 10,000 houses.
It's not going to really scratch the surface in terms of the housing crisis, is it?
It's just a headline.
No, exactly right. Yeah, but it's not even something that you could scale. You wouldn't go, oh, well, that worked well for 10,000 people. Let's do it for 100,000 now.
Yeah. And also, wouldn't those people just bid like 40% more?
Yeah. Doesn't it just push the prices up anyway? Yeah. Exactly right. Very short-term, kicking the can down the road, high time preference solution for sure. So a couple of regulation-type bits of news. We've got Senator Bragg who is very interested in digital assets and seems very intrinsically involved in some of the development of digital asset regulation. He hosted an Ask Me Anything on Reddit regarding his views of upcoming crypto and Bitcoin regulation. And he was, like, all of his comments were very curated. He was very careful about what he said. But generally speaking, he was quite positive. He seemed to be pretty informed about proof of work versus proof of stake, about the various different cryptocurrencies, about how CBDCs could have a lot of privacy issues. And so he had made a few comments that stood out to me, one of them being that, you know, we wouldn't be going ahead with an Australian sovereign digital currency like a CBDC unless things like privacy issues could be kind of addressed appropriately first. Now, what that means from the government, because I believe citizens and government have very different views of like what privacy means for a citizen. So that, you know, take that with a grain of salt. But that was really interesting that he made that comment.
I didn't realize he was in charge of the RBA, but anyway.
He is. That's right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it's like his choice, but
no,
it's exactly. Interesting that that's his opinion. Yeah,
true. He made some other comments where people were saying, look, Bitcoin is really bad for the environment. Would you consider banning proof of work until we're at like net zero emissions and then we can have all renewables and then people can mine Bitcoin with renewables? And he basically said, no, we're not looking at doing that. You know, we will try to encourage people to use things like renewables. And he kind of mentioned some of the things that he's already done in that space, but more or less said, like, it's not the government's decision to make those kind of choices. It's up to industry to follow the things that they're recommending. But at the same time, he doesn't see banning proof of work or banning Bitcoin or banning cryptocurrencies as a useful thing to do because it will just stifle innovation. And that's it's a hotly debated topic where it's not quite clear as proof of work being bad. So he had some sort of very good tempered responses to people there. Another one was around, should we ban or prioritize certain cryptocurrencies? And his view again was very, very libertarian, I guess, even though he might not, you know, classify himself as a libertarian, which was it's up to the free market. It's not the government's decision to say which cryptocurrencies should or shouldn't be used. It's up to people to decide that. What they're trying to do is create a framework that makes sure that illegal stuff isn't happening and that people are protected sufficiently. But it's not up to them to push a certain cryptocurrency or digital asset, which is interesting.
That is interesting because if you try and buy Monero on some of the exchanges, I don't think you can.
So no, it's not available on centralized exchanges in Australia, Monero.
Yeah, so that is an example where that hasn't come true.
True.
Is that something you can go back and get?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So I'll put that up in the show notes.
Cool.
Have a scroll through. There is a few points in there that are very triggering when you hear people's questions, especially around proof of work and energy, and because there's a lot more of that. Bitcoin uses as much energy as the whole country of Spain, and it does this just to enable ransomware attacks.
Right.
So are you going to ban Bitcoin? Like, there's a lot of questions like that. What I was reassured by was Senator Bragg's responses to many of those things were just a simple no.
Okay.
Or, this is an interesting question. Well, I've already put in a few different recommendations to government about this and this, but I feel like maybe there's a bit more to this debate than what you're putting out there. So he was very tempered in his responses, which is nice because I'm sure that would have been that could have gone a different way in my mind.
Yep.
So similar to this, the Australian Bitcoin industry body has canvassed all federal candidates, which is about 800 of them, to ask them whether they support Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies and whether they see that there's a difference between Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. And they've received responses from, last I checked, it was probably around 30 candidates, perhaps a little bit more now. Most of them were not very knowledgeable on Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. And most of the responses were, again, relatively curated, knowing that this could be quite an issue, maybe like a single issue for a lot of voters. So they wanted to kind of say, yes, we support it. Don't know a lot about it. I was looking into this after the election. So not really promising a whole lot, but also not shutting it down and saying, no, I think cryptocurrencies are bad or only for illicit activity and they should all be regulated or over-regulated. There was very kind of tempered responses, but leading up to an election, that's kind of what you would expect.
Yeah.
I will. I'll link that as well, actually, because I think as we get closer to the election, it might be useful to have another quick look over that to see your electorate. Has the candidate in your electorate even responded to that? And if they have, you know, where do they sit in terms of Bitcoin, crypto, or kind of neutral? So this is a bit of follow-up news. So there was a couple of ETFs, actually three ETFs, that were going to be issued for Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies on the secondary market in Australia. So not on the ASX, but on the CBOE. And my understanding is it's been delayed at the last minute because of it's called a prime broker, which is someone who is, I say someone, but likely institution, It wasn't disclosed who or what it was exactly, but they are essentially a market maker. So very, very important in terms of being able to service the, for lack of better terms, the volume that might be...
provide liquidity.
Exactly, yeah. Providing liquidity. And so this prime broker got to the point where they realized they wouldn't be able to service the three ETFs that were going to be released. They've been delayed. The intention is that they still are released sometime in May or June. So they're still going ahead. And of course, there's a lot of firms or funds here that are looking at setting up their own ETF, including like BetaShares and VanEck. So I think this is still directionally good news. But if anyone's wondering why there was a delay, nothing too nefarious. But I mean, look, the way I can interpret this in a good way is that perhaps there was like an oversubscription. Perhaps they saw that there was going to be perhaps too much volume for the market maker to be able to handle. And so things have been delayed until that extra infrastructure or liquidity can be provided.
Yeah, I mean, if they are using a market maker, the volatility would be a challenge compared to what they're probably used to doing,
yeah,
more traditional stuff. But yeah, it does seem like this just, we just have to wait a little bit. We're going to get probably more than one ETF.
So moving on to some technical news, BIP 119 or OP Check Template Verify or Covenants. So this is a pretty big topic. I'm going to throw out there what's been happening with it so far and know that this is not a topic that's over. It's not a topic that we'll probably have any like real firm stance of which way it might work out. I've got some comments as we go through, but if you want to find more detailed information, I'm going to post a few links. One is BIP119.com, which has actually an amalgamation of many, many articles, many, many podcasts, including the original BIP proposal itself. So you can get all the information there if you need. I'll also post up two really useful YouTube videos that kind of take two different sides of the argument in regard to BIP 119. So just to quickly describe a couple of terms here, a BIP is a Bitcoin improvement proposal. And anytime something is updated into the Bitcoin protocol, like Taproot very recently, or SegWit back in 2017, they start as a BIP, a Bitcoin improvement proposal, which lays out the reason for the improvement proposal, potential risks, potential ways of implementing it. And generally from that point, it goes through a lot of argument and debate and reaches some sort of social consensus to say, this seems like a good idea that we should move forward with. And then there's much more of a technical scrutiny. Now, it doesn't always follow that particular pathway, but generally speaking, most previous things that have been implemented into Bitcoin have had a social consensus. So it was a matter of saying, yes, we definitely want this. Now it's just a matter of what's the timing, what exactly does it look like, and what is the way that we're going to implement it? Will we do it with users switching it on? Will it be miners switching it on? How quickly will that process be? So all of these points are actually involved in this BIP 119 scenario. So just to clarify, this particular BIP, BIP 119, is called Check Template Verify, or it's to do with covenants. And it was proposed by Jeremy Rubin, who is a Bitcoin Core developer. He also is the founder of a company called Judica, which is focused on researching different ways of making Bitcoin kind of more accessible and having additional, I would say, like custodial and inheritance-based services. It's quite broad what Judica does, but covenants, which is what BIP 119 is all about, is a big part of their business. So what covenants actually are is allowing that when you receive a Bitcoin transaction, you can put stipulations on that transaction to say, well, once I receive it, when I go to spend it again after that, I can only spend it in certain amounts, or I can only spend it to certain whitelisted addresses. At the moment, we do have some limitations we can put on Bitcoin that we receive and then later want to spend. Like, for example, putting it in a multi-sig contract or putting a time lock on it, or even saying we want to just link it to someone's public key and, of course, the private key that underpins it, or even linking it to what's called like a pre-image or a secret. So I guess my point here is that we have some ability to put limitations onto Bitcoin transactions at the moment, but not to the extent that covenant allows us to do. And so covenants is good in the sense that it does allow better things like inheritance planning and security. So one example might be that you transfer money into a Bitcoin vault, let's just say. And in that vault, there's these stipulations that say you can actually now only spend this Bitcoin to certain addresses, say addresses that belong to your family members, or you can only spend 10% of it at a time with some time delays in between. What that would mean is if an attacker gets access to that vault, they cannot drain the funds and send it somewhere else to a wallet that they control. They would only be able to send it to a wallet you control in amounts that you've stipulated.
And you can see how, like, if you're, say, a country, you might want to have those that access to that sort of restrictions so that, you know, one person couldn't, you know, or two or three people couldn't use their multi-sig to take Bitcoin. It can only go to, you know, official places.
Exactly right.
So there is some merit there.
Definitely. And so overall, I would say I would support covenants, generally speaking, as something that we need in Bitcoin. I think the debate at the moment is it urgent? Like, do we need it right now? Mm. Does it need to be rushed through? Is this the best implementation of covenants, or is there a better way to do it?
Yeah.
There is some debate saying, should we put this on layer two, not layer one, so we don't possibly break things? But then the counter argument to that is generally, you can't put things on layer two that we don't have the functionality to do on layer one, because layer one is what kind of enforces
yep.
the layer two,
yep.
if that makes sense. Anything you put on layer two that's not possible to do on layer one is loose because it's only like an application level. So the reason that this has become something that's quite contentious is that BIP-119 has been out for, I want to say, about a year. It hasn't received much debate. It hasn't had social consensus. But Jeremy Rubin has gone to a lot of industry leaders, essentially like lobbied and convinced them, and then come back to Bitcoin Core developers and said, you're out of touch with the industry. The industry wants this. So you want to push through the activation by a miner activated soft fork using what's called speedy trial,
mm-hmm.
which says every time miners mine a block, they will signal whether they support BIP-119 or not. And if we receive 90% support within a certain time frame, then BIP-119 will go active.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is not the way that we've done implementations in the past, which is where there's a bit of pushback from users and some developers saying that we don't want this to be the way that, kind of bypassing users,
yeah.
that something so significant gets implemented, especially before proper scrutiny of the technicals have been undertaken to look at things like risks and to look at things like, is this the best in class implementation? So one of the risks that has been brought up, it's technical and it's also regulatory. So the risk is that potentially there could be what's called recursive covenants, where someone receives Bitcoin to an address with a covenant on it, and that covenant sets like a whitelist permanently to say, like, these Bitcoins can only be spent to a whitelisted address, and from there they can only ever be spent to a whitelisted address, and from there they can only ever be spent to a whitelisted address.
They're locked away.
Locked away, exactly. And then so there's fungibility issues there, because you say, well, then there's going to be a bunch of Bitcoin that's not in covenants, and there's going to be some that is, and those two things shall never meet again, potentially.
Yeah.
Now, technically, at least what has come out so far is to say that that's not possible. So the way that BIP-119 is looking at implementing covenants will not allow technically recursive covenants that lock things permanently to like whitelisted addresses. However, the other argument is that does open up the regulatory requirement, where right. if a government can say, well, you can create permanent whitelists by just only ever paying into an address that has a covenant set up, then maybe you should. And if the government thinks that you can do something, yeah. they have a better chance of enforcing it. Now, the counter argument to that has been, that's already possible with multisig. It's very easy for a government entity to say you can only withdraw from an exchange to an account that both you and we hold the keys for.
Right.
And from that point on, you can only ever send to an address that has both a government key and a private key. Therefore, the government's always the one that gets to either spend themselves, or they can be part of your transaction to yep. allow you to spend it. Now, I kind of understand that argument where it's like the risk is already there, but depends which way you look at it. It's like, if the door's already open, can it get any more open? Or is it like, if you have 10 doors to the same place, are you more likely to get there? And I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. I guess what concerned me originally about this was that level of scrutiny didn't seem to be there. People didn't have their heads yeah. around it entirely of like, well, is this that much more of a risk than what we've already got that we need to care about it? Or is it actually not that much more of a risk? And technically it's not possible, which means there's some benefits to covenants. Let's just sort of push forward with it.
So do you know this guy, what his agenda is to try and get it rushed through? Like, I'm assuming there's some other hidden agenda that he's not revealing.
That is what some of the debate is over. Yeah. The fact that he owns a company, he's founded a company called Judica, which stands to gain immensely from the yeah. implementation of covenants, but many other companies yep. would, and, yep. and so would the overall ecosystem. But he's definitely got an incentive to do this.
Mm.
And he hasn't gone about it by trying to lobby the users and then the developers and then the institutions. He's gone kind of the other way around. He's yep. gone to institutions and then gone to the developers and said, it's already a done deal. If you don't agree, you're out of touch.
Yep.
And let's just sort of push this onto the users, because this is something that they'll want. And I can see the benefit for covenants, but then again, the question is, do we need it now? Yeah. Does this have to be rushed through now? Is there maybe a better way to do this, either through another BIP or perhaps using this BIP, but implementing it in a nicer way, like a user-activated soft fork, or at least doing a miner-activated soft fork once the users are at least at social consensus to say, yes, we do want this now, as well as developers, of course.
Or is this even the highest priority change we need to make?
Exactly right. Is there something that should come before this?
Yeah.
Very true.
Yeah. I mean, I see it as a good test for Bitcoin's kind of procedures for how these things happen. You know, we had the situation with the small blocks and the large blocks and,
exactly,
you know, that failed. And I'm pretty confident that the people who are very passionate about it will prevent this from, you know, getting out of hand.
That's true. So there is something that's been suggested, which is a user-resisted soft fork, which would require an update to essentially set all nodes to, by default, say no to this update. Uh-huh. And what that would mean is that if there is a miner-activated soft fork where 90% or more of the miners say, yes, we want this implemented, but then the majority of users have this user-resisted soft fork, what that essentially means is to say, if you are mining a block that is compliant with BIP-119, we will not accept it.
So it's not valid.
That's right. Mm. But that could force a hard fork, which most miners would not want to do.
Yeah, right.
So this is sort of similar to the user-activated soft fork during SegWit, where they said to miners, we're going to upgrade, and if you mine blocks that don't upgrade to the same protocol, we won't accept your block.
Yeah.
And so you can either hard fork off, or you can join us in this user-activated soft fork. And so miners joined, of course. So we're not sure exactly what's going to happen now, but it seems to me like this is something that's going to be pushed out a bit further. I don't think a miner-activated soft fork is going to have us having covenants in the next few months. That seems unlikely, especially if there's talk now of kind of upgrading nodes to resist that in the first place.
Yep.
So as an interesting point, Jeremy Rubin has put up a bounty of 5.5 Bitcoin to say he challenges anyone to break BIP-119 to be able to like exploit it or abuse it. And if that's possible, 5.5 Bitcoin is yours. He's done quite a lot of work in terms of putting out videos, documentation. So it's hard to see. He's definitely got an incentive, but he seems to be going about the educational process somewhat in the right way, but maybe targeting what I would say is the wrong people first, which makes it look bad.
Gets people on the back foot.
And gets people on the back foot, exactly. So I think what's I'd like to sort of maybe just reiterate is that this is a messy situation. However, this is what happens when we are trying to find consensus without an authority figure.
Yeah.
This is not a democratic situation where 60% say yes and the 40% have to deal with it. This is not where you can take it to a leader and say, you tell us the process, what do we do from here? This is messy because it's literal thousands and hundreds of thousands of people trying to formulate some sort of firm opinion one way or the other on this thing that's they're now just finding out about it. And this is how Bitcoin's meant to work. It would be scary if there was one person that could have that call.
Yes. Yeah.
Or if 60% could outvote the 40%. I guess one final point here, which I found really interesting, is that this has brought up the debate about should we have a standardized process for this to occur? If this has put people on the back foot, maybe we should always reach social consensus first, do technical next, and then go to institutions afterwards. But the debate has been, if we have a standardized process and it's not organic in nature, that's something that can be gamed or exploited.
And then even to agree on what the standardized process is could be gamed.
Exactly. Absolutely right. Yeah. And so having this messy but organic process is, in my mind, what Bitcoin should be about. We shouldn't have this clear kind of like follow the bouncing ball or go through the meat grinder process to do, because then it's easy for any kind of malicious actor, state or otherwise, to try to commandeer that process once you know how to game it. So this is good, I think, what's happening at the moment, even though maybe initially it was a bit scary that something was being pushed through that a lot of people didn't agree with.
Yeah, but it also tells you, you know, if you can, you know, run a node, you effectively have a vote.
Exactly.
That's where the real power is, because only the nodes can accept the new blocks.
That's it. And I think that's just a good point to reiterate about Bitcoin is that, yeah, it's not a democracy. It's something where you have to go in and choose to run the new software. And if you don't like BIP-119 when it is implemented, you don't actually have to upgrade to that software. Your node will still accept blocks just as well. You just won't have those additional features that BIP-119 comes with. So look, interesting situation. I at the moment lean on the side of do not support, just purely because I'd like to see more social consensus. I'd like to hear more technical detail about how this won't lead to things like recursive covenants. Although I feel pretty confident that they won't now, but it would be good to see, like, are there any other risks that we haven't considered? Is there a better way to do this? And then, of course, the point that you even mentioned is, is there something better that we should be doing first that's not even to do with covenants? Is there something more urgent?
Yep.
So that's kind of where I stand at the moment, but we'll have to see how it shapes up. Well, that's pretty much it for today. It's a pretty packed session. Global news, local news, and some of that technical at the end. If you're interested to hear any more about those topics, check out the show notes. And again, if you're keen to get 6 months of free Bitcoin batched withdrawals using Hardblock's autosend feature, then use the affiliate code, or the affiliate link, in the show notes below this post. Thanks for listening, and until next time.